So we're in the series called Like a Good Neighbor, and we're in the series for a couple reasons. One is that we went through a series before this talking about God's mission for us, and we learned from Acts chapter 17 that God has kind of a twofold mission for us, and it's one, to know Him, and two, to show Him. And so then when we came out of that book, when we came out of the study of Acts, we began to ask this question, well, what does it mean for me? I mean, I kind of understand what it means, umbrella terms, like as a person, I'm supposed to know God, I'm supposed to show Him generally to the people that I know. And I kind of know what it means for a church, but what does it mean for me on an everyday, daily basis with my coworkers and my family and my neighbors and things like that? And so I suggested you download this book. It's a free book available online called Discover Your Mission Now. It's like we're all impatient. Discover it now. But it's actually a process. It's like a 5-step process. And many of our life groups are reading through this book. It's free. The QR code will take you to the spot on our site where you can click the link and get to the other site so you can fill in your email address so you can get the link by email to download the book. It's a little jumble, but at least it's free. Anyway, so we're going through this, and it's a 5-step process of trying to identify what your individual unique mission is. And it's not really simple, but the process is simple. And today we're on step 4 of that 5-step process. We're going to be looking a little bit about this idea of serving people, and that's the 4th word of this kind of recipe in the book. Now, I'm not giving you exactly what shows up in the book, because in the book there's a passage where the author tells us about a time when Jesus served a blind man by healing him. But for us, we kind of wonder, what does it mean for us to serve? And when you look at Jesus' life, He's always serving people. In fact, we're going to get to that in just a moment. But what we're going to do is we're going to take all of this and just begin to think, okay, what would Jesus really want me to do, practically speaking, first? What's the first thing He'd want me to do? So we've been looking at this passage, Matthew 22. And it says, Jesus is talking and He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And so the first thing He wants us to do is to love God and have a relationship with Him. But immediately after that, just on the heels of that, He says, now you need to love your neighbor. And the question that we've asked is, what if Jesus actually meant my neighbor, the person who lives next to me, the people in my neighborhood, the people in my nearby community, the people closest to me? What if He really meant love them? See, you know what we do is we do this kind of thing. We say about some person out there, some person we don't even know their name, and we're like, I love that person. You know, the tragedy happened in some other state, and the newscaster says, send your thoughts and prayers. And so then what we do is we do this warm, fuzzy love kind of thing, where what we do is we just feel good at the television. We just feel good at the television. And we're like, okay, I'm going to love this person from a distance. And some of us might actually pray for those people, but some of us are just like, okay, I'm just going to feel love at them. And we think that's sort of good. And then when we apply it to our neighbors, we get into a lot of trouble. Because, you know, you see the ambulance show up at your neighbor's house, and you feel love towards the wall. Just right through the wall, I'm just going to feel love towards you. I don't know your name. I don't know what your situation is. I don't know why the ambulance is there, but I'm just going to feel love right towards you. Sometimes we do that, and we call that love, that I'm just feeling the warm, good, positive feelings towards someone else. But what if Jesus meant to do love, to do loving things, to show love for them? And so I'm challenging us to be good neighbors. Now, a couple weeks ago, we saw a Seinfeld clip of Jerry Seinfeld not being a very good neighbor. And I'm going to show you another clip just because I think Seinfeld is one of the world's greatest commentaries on modern society. And some of you I know are too young to even know what Seinfeld is. It was a television show back in the 90s about some really morally corrupt people who did a whole lot of morally corrupt things, but it was hilarious. And that's why we watched. And that's why my wife bought me the whole entire 9 seasons on DVD. So you get some of it. And as a result, I'm going to show you this one little clip. And this clip illustrates a principle that's true about you and all of your neighbors. The principle goes like this. You're not good enough to handle your life. Seriously. You're not good enough to handle your life. None of your neighbors are good enough to handle their lives. None of us can handle life by ourselves. So watch this clip and maybe it'll inspire something in you.
I have a friend. Today would have been his whole life.
Now, what time are you picking me up tonight?
Huh?
You got reservations at Sfuzzy, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, Sfuzzy. I got to do that.
Should I wear the outfit I bought today?
Sure.
Which one?
The one with the plum.
You know what? If I'm going to get my haircut, I better go now. Call me when you get home. I won't be there, but leave a message so I know you called.
Okay, okay.
Do you mind?
No, I'll grab it. What, did you lose your remote?
Nah, cable's out. You look dead.
It's Lynette. I need like an assistant or an intern or something.
Relationship intern. What if the two of us teamed up? Listen, we're always sitting here. I'm always helping you with your girl problems. You're always helping me with my girl problems. Where do we end up?
Here.
Exactly. Because neither one of us can handle a woman all by ourselves.
I'm trying.
I've tried. We don't have it. But maybe the two of us working together at full capacity could do the job of one normal man.
Each of us would only have to be like a half man. That sounds about right.
Yeah. For the 7:15 of Lenore's Promise. What are you wearing, a green sweater?
I like it.
No, that doesn't. Here, it's your blue one. It's your favorite.
What?
Just put it on. Maybe she got her nails done today. So, remark on how you like the color. And if you need me, you beat me, all right? Yeah, there you go. Come on. Go get
George, one second. She's having a party Friday night, and she wants me to take care of the invitations.
Lenore's would have helped. How many people?
35. And George, on the invitation.
Yes. I know. Don't skip. Go.
Right, I'm trying my life back.
I like your nails. That is a great color.
Love sweater.
This whole thing.
Now, there are a couple things that really date that show. Did you notice George, the bald guy, the shorter bald guy, he's like, if you need something, beep me. Any of you know what that means? There were these things called pagers a while ago. So this is like back in the 90s. We're talking like 15 years ago or more. This show was around, and they were talking about paging you with, it was a little device you would wear like on your belt or put in your pocket or something, and all it would do is make a beep sound and then have like numbers on it for how you could call someone back. It's like text messaging before text messaging really was practical. And it was thought to be cool at the time. And then the spray stuff, did you see that spray stuff he was spraying at the guy? Do they still make Banaca? The world's most awesome candy. I'm just telling you, this stuff, you do like 13 sprays of the cinnamon right under your tongue. Woo! It gets you. So I don't know if they still make it anymore, but I'm just dating myself a little bit there with all this. I was thinking through this concept that long, long time ago, it was common for people to have servants in their house. The It's a Wonderful Life movie. You know, the guy, he's living at his home before he gets married, and in his home, there's a servant lady there. And she's doing cooking and cleaning and stuff, and she's a servant. And then later on, you get to the Brady Bunch. And the Brady Bunch, they had a lot of kids, so they had an excuse, but they had Alice who was living there. In fact, she was so much a part of the family, she was even in the logo. She, you know, when the TV show started, her face popped up right in the center because Alice was like the center of everything. I don't know. So they had a servant just for kids. And then there was this TV show, I don't know if any of you watched it because it was kind of lame, with Scott Baio, called Charles in Charge. What was that all about? A live-in nanny, because this lady had two children, one of which was in high school, and so she had a live-in male nanny, a manny, and a grandmother who also lived in the house and apparently did nothing. But somehow Charles was there to take care of the house and be kind of in charge of everything. And then these guys come along later on, and they can't even manage a girlfriend. Okay. So that was 15 years ago. Are we doing better today? Is life simpler today? No. So where's my servant? That's the deal. I mean, that's the real question. Think about this. I'm just going to ask you, how many of you, be honest with me, raise your hand and tell me, how many of you have all of your online passwords memorized? That's because you're using one password for everything, aren't you? Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you got use one email address and one password for everything. I can remember that one. But how many accounts do you have online? I mean, I have accounts with websites that I don't even remember. I don't even know if they exist anymore. Sometimes I get these emails from them like, we got bought out, yay! And I'm like, who are you and why did I sign up for that? Or something like that. I don't know. But life is more complex now. And we are all managing more systems than have ever been managed. And so we buy devices that claim to be smart enough to help us. But the smartphone in your pocket is really a dumb phone because it's dumbinizing you. It is dumbinizing all of us because I can't remember anything anymore. I put it in the phone and I'm like, I don't even remember where it is in the phone. You know, so speed dial. No one remembers their own phone number anymore because I don't call my own number. So, and I don't call anyone else's number. It's just in the speed dial or the contacts list or whatever. Here's the situation. We have got our lives so complicated, and it's not just us, it's everybody. Your neighbors, if I were to make a guess, have a life that is nearly as complicated as yours. No one has a life as complicated as yours, but theirs is nearly complicated as yours, right? Let me ask you one more question. What if there was a person who came alongside you and said, this one system I will totally take care of? Some system in your life. They're going to read all your emails and tell you which ones are worth paying attention to. Oh, that would be sweet. Yeah. Or they're going to take care of one issue around your house. You know, you can clean your house, but I'm just going to take care of this one thing in your house. What would it be like if you actually had a servant, even to just do one thing for you? One time, it would kind of feel like they cared for you. Now, if we hired the Manny and he took care of things, then we're paying the person, and then it doesn't feel as much like they care for us, but what if they just offered it to us? We'd feel loved and cared for. And the amazing thing is that when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, I believe he is saying, what would cause you to know they love you? Well, if they served me, that's one way. Therefore, flip it. Do for the other person what would speak love to you. Serve them. I believe your neighborhood needs some servants. And I believe your neighbors need a servant in you. And I want to show you that Jesus was not above this himself. We read Jesus' own words in Mark 10, where he says this. The Son of Man, it should come up on the screen, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came to this earth not to receive our service, but to be a servant for us. So, we could look at all of Jesus' life to identify what it means to be a servant, but there's an interesting passage in the Old Testament, 1 Samuel 25. If you've got the Bibles we passed out, it's on page 203. Go ahead and flip there. In 1 Samuel 25, we see a picture of a servant that is really interesting, a little bit weird, and fascinating all at the same time. And I'll set it up as you're flipping there, as you're tapping your buttons to get there. So in 1 Samuel 25, we come to a story where Samuel has just died. And Samuel is the prophet who anointed David to be the king. But before he anointed David to be the king, he anointed a guy named Saul to be the king. The problem was that Saul was a loser when it came to issues of obedience to God. And so God gave up on Saul. He said, okay, fine, I'm done with you. I'm going to even remove my spirit from you. And you're just going to go ahead and be the king and do whatever you want to do, but it's not going to be with me. And so then Saul is completely without God's help, completely without God's fellowship. And God says, I'm now going to pay attention to David. And so Samuel goes to David, anoints David to be the next king. And you know some of David's story. You know how he took a sling and he put a rock in it and he flung it around and he knocked a guy named Goliath in the head and then he went up and cut the guy's head off and he killed Goliath, this giant, and David was the dude. And the whole country began to know that David's the dude and they loved him and they said, you know, David can kill anything. David can conquer anyone. He's our guy. And Saul began to hear this and he began to get a little bit upset. And as a process of him not having God's Spirit anymore, and David apparently having both God's Spirit and the favor of the people, Saul got really mad at David and tried to kill him. And so David goes running. He takes off and he runs away because he says, even though God anointed me to be the king, he also anointed Saul to be the king. And so until Saul stops being the king, I won't start being the king. And I'm not going to do anything to Saul because he is God's anointed king. David was so so desiring of honoring God that he wouldn't touch Saul, even though Saul was out to get him. So David just ran. He said, I'm just going to run around, be in the wilderness until Saul dies or until God takes him or something. I'm just going to be out there. So now we come to this story. David's on the run. Saul is just a couple chapters of getting killed from, you know, that's God's dealing with Saul. But Samuel just dies, and so David is kind of on his own. And we pick up the story, 1 Samuel 25, verse 1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah. Then David moved down into the desert of Paran, because he's got to get away, you know. He's got to move farther away. A certain man in Maon, who had property there at Carmel, was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband was surly and mean in his dealings. He was a Calebite. While David was in the wilderness, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. So he sent 10 young men and said to them, go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them. When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. So here's what's going on. David's been in the wilderness with these guys. He's got 600 men who've chosen to follow him. But even though he's got an army, he's not attacking Saul. He's not getting rid of Saul. So he's got 600 men who are following him, who are hanging out with him. And he's out there in the desert, and he notices there are these shepherds out there. And so he kind of takes care of these shepherds a little bit. Now, the phrase that he uses is really interesting. He says, we did not mistreat them. If we use that phrase today, you say, well, of course you shouldn't mistreat them. I mean, be human to each other. Okay, so that's good. You're a shepherd out in the field. I'm out in the field with 600 guys, and I didn't mistreat your guys. So reward me. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. It sounds like a protection racket. It sounds like extortion for money, you know? I didn't kill your guys, so now pay up, something like that. But that's not what's happening. Because see, back in these days, if you wanted to be humble, you wouldn't say the bold boasting thing. David wouldn't say, hey, we've been super nice to your guys, because that's kind of boasting. And so he has to say it the same thing, but more humbly. And in that culture, what they would do is they would use a double negative. And a double negative means exactly the opposite of what would ordinarily be meant. So for him saying, we didn't mistreat them, he's actually saying, we treated them really well. We treated them really well. We're going to find out in just a few verses how well they treated them. But the bottom line is that they built kind of like a human fence of 600 warriors all around the shepherds so that the shepherds could be safe. And they wouldn't be bothered by traveling robbers or people who would sneak in the middle of the night and steal stuff or whatever, because being a shepherd was kind of a dangerous occupation, being out there in the open all the time. And so David took his 600 men and built a wall all around the shepherds. And now he says to Nabal, it's shearing time, which means all the work of shepherding has now paid off. We're going to shear the sheep and get the wool. We're going to slaughter a bunch of them and pay off the shepherds. And we're going to celebrate and have a party. And so David says, because it's celebration time, and because you have all of your sheep with you, none of them were stolen, can we join in the festivities? Just give us whatever you want to give us. Nabal's response, verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Everybody knows David. He killed Goliath. Everybody knows David. He's the guy who was in Saul's court and then ran away because Saul was trying to kill him. Everybody knows David, but Nabal says, well, who's this guy? Who's this son of Jesse? He even knows who his dad is. Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I've slaughtered from my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where? It's just a direct insult to David. I don't care what you've done for me, David. As far as I know, you just ran away from Saul, and it's really your fault. David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, each of you strap on your sword. So they did, and David strapped his on as well. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. One of the servants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us." See, there we actually get the message. It's not that they didn't mistreat them. They were very good to us. They did not mistreat us. And the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He's such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. Abigail acted quickly. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, "Go on ahead, I'll follow you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, "It's been useless all my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness, so that nothing of his was missing. He's paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." In other words, he's saying, "May God curse me if I don't wipe Nabal out and all of his dudes in his house." When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "Pardon your servant, my lord." And that's the key. Something's going on here where Abigail refers to herself as "your servant" and refers to David as "my lord." And let me speak to you. Hear what "your servant" has to say. This is code language, because she is actually using the terminology that people use when they're talking to a king. When people back then were talking to a king, they would say to the king, "my master," and they would refer to themselves as "your servant." So when a person was saying "my lord," they were talking about the king. And when a person would say "your servant," they were talking about themselves. And when they would talk to the king, they would say to the king, "my lord, your servant." And that's the way they talked. She's using the same language to David that she should be using to a king. But it comes with that concept of servanthood very strongly present. And so I call this section the rules for servants. We're going to look at just a few of these rules, and the first rule that we get to isn't really a rule. That's why I've numbered it 0. It's really more of a preliminary warning. And we take this warning from David himself. The warning is simply this: that when you expect something, when you serve with expectation, you are often disappointed. See, what David was doing is he was serving Nabal, right? He had his men surrounding their sheep shearers and their shepherds and stuff, and protecting them. David was kind of serving Nabal, but it wasn't service. What it was is it was favor doing. And there's a difference. There's a difference between serving someone and doing a favor. David was doing Nabal a favor so that he could get something back. He said, "I will take care of your shepherds. You give me something back when it's time for me to ask for something. Let's do a I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of situation." And oftentimes that's the way we view service. We serve other people so that someday they will owe us, so that someday they will give something back to us. But that's not service. That's favor doing. That's a relationship of either a boss and employee, or a master and a slave, or two friends who are just scratching each other's backs. Service is something totally different. The attitude of service is this: I take what I have and I offer it for your benefit. And that's the end of the story. I take what I have, my time, my talent, my strength, whatever it is that I have, and I offer it to you for your benefit without any strings attached. I offer it to you for your benefit. End of story. The next time you need to receive a benefit, I can still offer it again, because I'm not keeping track of how many times I have served you. Because service is not about the action, nor is it about the person doing it. Service is always about the person it's being done for. So I'm not a servant unless I'm intentionally trying to benefit someone else. Now, David was trying to do kind of a negotiation relationship. So there's your warning. If you serve expecting something back, you're probably going to be disappointed. And at least you're not really serving. But Abigail does demonstrate service. And so let's take a look at what she does. First of all, the first thing you should recognize in what Abigail does after she admits that she's the servant, she comes up to David, and this is really interesting. In verse 25, she says, "Please pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man Nabal. He's just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him. As for me, your servant, I did not see the men my lord sent. And now, my lord, as surely as the Lord your God lives, and as you live, since the Lord has kept you from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, may your enemies and all who are intent on harming my lord be like Nabal." In other words, she's saying, God has stopped you from killing Nabal. God has prevented you from avenging Nabal. That's pretty smart, because she's doing the preventing right then. She says, God's preventing, but may all of your enemies in the future be just like this loser. May all of your enemies in the future be just like Nabal. Because maybe God is going to do something to Nabal. But let's keep going. She says this, "And let this gift which your servant has brought to my lord be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's presumption." There's something weird there. She is the one in front of him calling herself his servant. So when she says your servant, she's referring to herself. So she says, please forgive your servant. She's talking about herself. See, David is all uptight because Nabal has sent an insult his way. And David is ready to avenge this insult. He's ready to kill Nabal in response to this insult. And Abigail goes to David and she says, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. What? Why does David need to forgive her for anything? Here's what it is. Servant, this is your first rule of being a servant. Servants always take personal responsibility for whatever the situation is. A servant takes personal responsibility for what the situation is. If you hire someone to come into your house and be your servant, and then 2 weeks later, the bathrooms are not cleaned, whose fault is it? It's the servant's fault, right? Because the servant is the person who's been given that task or whatever. Now, that's a situation where there's a job to do and it gets assigned to the person, and it's really more like boss-employee than it is real service, because service you just do for someone's benefit. But a servant still takes the same mentality. If there's something going on with you, I take responsibility for it. We all the time want to blame other people. You know, and my next-door neighbor, his lawn is getting really raggedy, let's say. And it's just really bothering me. You know, it's all messed up. And I'm thinking I could mow his lawn. In fact, maybe I will mow his lawn. And so then I go out and I mow his lawn. And I'm out there and I'm mowing it. And the whole time, you know what's going through my head? I'm mowing his lawn. I'm mowing this and I'm either thinking disdainfully about him, what a jerk that he can't manage this himself, or I'm thinking uppity about myself. What awesome neighbor I am. I'm mowing his lawn. I'm feeling really good. But a servant doesn't do either of those. A servant takes personal responsibility. This is an issue where someone else is not being blessed. And I'm going to take personal responsibility to make sure they get blessed for their sake. Not to alleviate my own issues or my own problems. It's for them. I'm going to bless them. I'm going to lift them up. A servant takes personal responsibility. Number two. Well, before we get to number two, I want to show you this verse. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Jesus himself does this exact thing for us. It says, he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. You see, the New Testament is very clear. Jesus, when he dies on the cross, he takes your sins and my sins and puts them on himself. He takes personal responsibility for the stuff that you've done. Jesus takes personal responsibility for the times I've screwed up. Even though it's my fault, he takes responsibility for it. He takes all the sin on himself and then he says to the Father, Father, forgive me. take this stuff away. I give you my spirit. He says, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I'm taking it on myself. That's the gist of what Jesus is doing there on the cross. So, a servant always takes personal responsibility for the situation. Now, let's do number two. Number two, the second thing you see is that a servant always brings their best to the situation. A servant doesn't just do half-hearted jobs like we might do in an employee relationship just to get by. A servant does the best they can do. Abigail puts hundreds of fig cakes and hundreds of raisin cakes on the donkey. And she takes multiple sheep to David. And she brings all this food, but more than that, you know what she brings to David? She brings a really, really well thought out speech. The things she says to David are brilliant. You should study this in terms of how to motivate people. You should study her speech in terms of how to inspire people, how to persuade people. And look at what she says here. In verse 26 is where she said, forgive. Let's keep reading. The Lord your God will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my Lord, because you fight the Lord's battles and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. He is just about to kill someone for an insult. That's very close to wrongdoing, I would say, if not totally across the line. And she says, no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my Lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. She says, listen, I know Saul is chasing you. And I know that you haven't killed Saul. I know you're such a good guy, you don't need to kill the guy who's your enemy. I know you can let him live. Hint, hint. Don't come and kill my husband. But then beyond that, she says, your enemies, God will cast away from you like a sling, like as from a sling, which is his Goliath story. She knows David so well that she can pull from David's own personal story exactly what he needs to hear so that he can lay off this revenge. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. She brings her best to this situation. And I say, as a servant, you need to bring your best to the situation. And then as she's doing that, she's consistently telling David that God is going to bless him. Keep going. It says verse 30, when the Lord has fulfilled for my Lord every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him ruler over Israel, my Lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord your God has brought my Lord success, remember your servant. She says, God is going to bless your socks off. And when you enter your kingdom and God is blessing you, you will not have on your conscience this stupid slaying of this fool Nabal. Don't let this bother you, because God is going to bless you. Here's the next point. A servant offers affirmation and blessing. A servant offers affirmation and blessing. When I serve someone, it's my tendency to look down on them and to pump myself up. I want to ask questions like, what's wrong with them? Why are they in this situation? Why don't they have their life together well enough to deal with this stuff? Even though I know my life isn't together well enough to deal with all my stuff. You know? But I look at them and I have a tendency to think negatively about the person who needs help. And that's completely wrong. A servant will say, I'm going to affirm you. I'm going to bless you. Number four, keep reading. David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. Then David accepted from her hand what she'd brought him and said, go home in peace. I've heard your words and granted your request. When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk. Nabal is taking all the food that he didn't give to David, and he's treating himself the way David should be treated. David's the king. He just hasn't taken his throne yet. But Nabal, he's pretending to be, and he's doing quite well at it. He's drunk, so she told him nothing at all until daybreak. That's another little tip. You know, don't talk to drunk people because they're not going to hear you until daybreak anyway. So then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. The dude goes into a coma when his wife tells him she took so much food over to David. I don't know what was worse, that he helped David out or that she took so much food. I don't know what the situation was, but, you know, so anyway, he goes into a coma. And then about 10 days later, verse 38, 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. 10 days. David wanted to kill him on one day. God took care of it just 10 days later. Here's the point. Jot this down. Servants always let someone else be the judge. They always let someone else be the judge. And that brings us to this last point. When you're serving someone, it can be very tempting to not serve them, particularly a neighbor or something like that, because you're afraid of becoming an enabler. You know, the kind of person who always needs the same kind of help over and over and over again, because they're always making the same bad decisions over and over and over again. And if you continue to offer the same kind of help for the same bad decision over and over again, eventually that person is just going to become dependent on you, and you're going to get into a codependent kind of relationship, and it's going to be a mess, and everybody talks about how bad that is. And so quite often, sometimes we say, well, I'm not going to help you at all because I'm afraid of becoming an enabler. I'm afraid of getting into a codependent relationship with you or something like that, so I'm just not going to help you at all. But let me ask you to take a different perspective. Because see, if Abigail were helping Nabal, she would have been enabling him. That was a joke that I didn't even intend. But if she were helping him, that would have been enabling him. Because he's the loser. He's the morally corrupt guy. He's the fool. His name means fool. And so if she were helping him out, if that's who she was serving, then it would have been enabling. But she's not serving him, is she? What about the men who are the servants and the shepherds? Is she serving them? In a sense, yeah. Because see, David was on his way to kill all of them. And Nabal might have deserved to die, as we find out that God killed him anyway. Nabal deserved to die, but these other guys, they were innocent. They were just shepherds. They were just doing their job. And so David was going to get them too? That would have been totally wrong. But you know what? Abigail serves the servants by going to David. And then even more than that, she's really serving David. Because he's the king. And he's the right person that she's supposed to be serving. And she's offering herself. And she's offering her resources. She's offering her wealth to him. That's who she's really serving. And so here's the deal. If you're worried about enablement, come back to this last point. Servants ultimately know whom they serve. Servants know whom they serve. And with you and your neighbors, it's not your neighbors necessarily you're serving. It's your Father in heaven. So listen, you might have a neighbor who always has the same problem. Don't worry about helping them out multiple times. Because God's in charge. And he can solve whatever is the big problem. And maybe your 42nd time of helping them in the same exact way will somehow trip a trigger with them and they'll say, you know what? Maybe I need to think about this more seriously. If you begin to get totally lost, just put yourself in Flanders' position next to the Simpsons. Okay? Continue to be the good person, even though the neighbor is continually being the not good person. I don't care. But so that's neither here nor there. Here's the deal. I'm going to give you three simple steps to leave this place with. Number one, keep praying for your neighbors. Keep praying for your neighbors. Get to know who lives in what house and pray for them. Number two, get to know them well enough to learn from them what would help them. Get to know them well enough to learn from them what would help them. And then, lastly, do it. Do so. Find moments to do it. Find moments to do so for them, just to figure out ways of blessing them. I'm bringing this up because I believe if we're going to be good neighbors, we have to be people who are intentionally serving, not because other people deserve it, maybe because they need it, but more so because that's who we are. More so just because we are servant type people, and that's who we need to be. And so no matter how annoying or weird or frustrating your coworkers or your neighbors or your family members can be, we are servants. That's just who we are. So, with all that said, I want to ask you to jot down some thoughts on the back side of that card. We're going to take a few moments in reflection and just ask God, in this situation that I'm dealing with, in my neighborhood, in my family, how can I be a servant to these people? Give me wisdom to know the difference between serving and enabling. Give me the right perspective. But let's just spend some time listening to God speak to us.
Thank you for listening to this message from Lafayette Community Church. We believe that God has a full and fulfilling life in store for you, and we want to help you live it. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me, Pastor Jeff, through the web form at lafayettecommunitychurch.com. And as always, I encourage you to plug into a solid, God-honoring community wherever you may be. Life is a journey, and no one should ever walk alone.